From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The United States faces many interlocking foreign policy and national security threats. During a recent visit to Raleigh, the head of a group called American Defense International analyzed those threats. The term efficiency gap crops up in debates about electoral redistricting in North Carolina. You'll hear highlights from a recent debate about the term. You'll learn why state lawmakers voted to override Governor Roy Cooper's veto of a bill dealing with credit insurance. And we'll wade through the latest numbers assessing North Carolina public school performance. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
They both began as projects their supporters said would create jobs and economic growth in North Carolina. But 10 years later, the Randy Parton Theater in Roanoke Rapids has left that city millions of dollars in debt. And a quarter of a century later, the Global Transpark in Kinston is still searching for a plan that works. Carolina Journal has been reporting on both of these stories for years now, and Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins me with an update. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start first with Roanoke Rapids. Now, Carolina Journal had reported on this and on the feasibility studies before this actually got going a decade ago, showing that there were projections that weren't really likely to occur. And in fact, this thing went belly up.
Yes, it sure did. In fact, it was supposed to create something like 12,000 jobs in the area. The notion of putting an entertainment center by I-95 in Roanoke Rapids to make a little sort of like a mini Branson or something like that, a place that would attract people who were driving from New York to Florida. They would suddenly stop and see a show and do all sorts of other entertainment events. Well, that actually didn't pan out very well, but it did to the tune of $21 million cost of the theater, which was entirely subsidized by taxpayers, most of it from the state. And Randy Parton, who was the operator of the theater, Dolly Parton's younger brother, put none of his own money into the project at all. He had no stake in it other than whether or not if it was going to give him employment for a while. And I believe he was getting under a salary something like $1.5 million a year to operate it. The theater had its first performance on the 26th of July in 2007, and Randy Parton was kicked out less than 6 months later.
Is this place still open?
Yes. It is now called the Roanoke Rapids Theater. It does a handful of performances a year. Seats about, I think, 1,500 people, something like that. And it does some, second-tier country western acts, shows, along those lines, convention events and that type of thing. But it's still, the city has a $15 million tab it still owes on the theater, and their debt service is nearly $1 million a year. And it's only bringing in a couple hundred thousand dollars in revenue or something like that. So the city's way underwater on it.
So this is a really something that is just hung around the neck of the taxpayers there having to deal with it. At the time that this was all being developed, Rick, I mean, it seemed clear to those, I think, who were looking at the data, the projections and the likelihood of the location and et cetera, that it was going to be an uphill climb for this to meet expectations. Any of those officials who made those decisions, are they still around or have they acknowledged the failure of this?
Most of them have sort of slinked away and completely walked away from anything that happened. A couple of the developers actually still have economic development jobs in other places. It was a terrible idea from the beginning. It was destined to be a boondoggle. But yet the notion of bringing, Dolly Parton's less talented younger brother to run an entertainment center in Roanoke Rapids had some appeal for people. And in a lot of these areas of eastern North Carolina, especially northeastern part of the state, they're just so desperate to grab on to what they think is going to be the magic attraction, the one thing that's going to all of a sudden revive the local economy, when in many cases there's not one single thing that's going to do it. In fact, there are many things that may not do it. In some cases, these local economies are just not going to ever recover in the way that they did when they were manufacturing places.
This, in some ways, has turned out to be the cautionary tale for what happens when you have outsized expectations and people who understandably want their area to thrive. They want new jobs. We can all understand that. But really, in almost sending a message to other local officials that this is not the way to go about it.
And yet they keep doing it.
Indeed, they do. And speaking of things that we do a quarter of a century ago, the Global Trans Park in the Kinston area. Now, that project was deemed as in many of the same types of ways. It was going to make that area thrive. It was supposed to be a big manufacturing hub, a just-in-time manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And now, 25 years later, it's never really panned out either.
No, it had even larger, more grandiose aspirations at the time. We're talking at that time about 48,000 direct jobs created there. It was using an old airport, and the idea was you would be able to transport raw materials by boat or rail up to this location in Kinston, where then you would be manufactured, they would be assembled, they would be then shipped back out through major centers. And it just, for one thing, the surrounding highways were never sufficient to provide that level of transportation. And secondly, it was just basically a really expensive, glorified industrial park that didn't have an anchor tenant and still does not really have an anchor tenant. It's gotten something like $200 to $300 million in taxpayer support over time. And yet, the closest thing to an anchor tenant it has now is a Spirit AeroSystems, which does some assembly of some airplanes. But still, it only has 1,000 private sector jobs and about 400 public sector jobs there. Much less than the 48,000 that were anticipated there.
Oh, that's huge. And in fact, now the General Assembly has directed this new director to create a new plan.
Right. This will be the third strategic plan that has been set up since the park opened back in 1992. And in this case, the idea is to make sure that somehow or other it can use a rail spur, 6 mile rail spur, which was built and provided with an additional $24 million in public funding. When Spirit got there, Spirit wasn't even using it. So they built this rail spur that Spirit said it was going to use, and it hasn't used it. And now there's some are saying that it is beginning to find some use for the rail spur to get deliver equipment back and forth to the shipping lanes and that sort of things. But still, it's been an incredible disappointment. Mike Walden from NC State University did a very critical report about it at the time, which got him into a bit of trouble because he was the one naysayer, if you will, among the folks who are familiar with the economic development side of North Carolina business, who just said the numbers didn't really add up for him. And it was one of the things that Governor Jim Martin was convinced was going to be a huge economic driver, and it really just never has panned out.
Rick, as I was looking at Carolina Journal's updated reporting on this, and by the way, both of these stories are available at carolinajournal.com. Rick, both of these projects, the Randy Parton Theater and the Global Trans Park, when you talk about them, it sounds like a good idea, and one can understand why some people will get caught up in wanting to do, quote, good things for the place that they live in. But again, it's the economic data and how the market forces work that seems to really be the common factor here in both cases.
Right. And in both cases also, these were extremely innovative ideas. In other words, you were expecting to have the a city of Roanoke Rapids build an entertainment pavilion anchored around one person who wasn't really all that famous. In the case of the Global Trans Park, a just-in-time manufacturing facility that, again, was taxpayer-supported and didn't have a tenant. And so it's not – so they sort of build it and they will come. Well, not necessarily. You have to have something for them to come to that's attractive. And in both of these cases – the project failed because there really wasn't a market for what it was offering.
Well, these two stories really are great examples, not only for taxpayers to be reading to understand how their money is put into projects with dubious results, and also for all of those local officials who are seeking ways to try to get the economy in their areas going. You can read both of these stories at CarolinaJournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The United States faces a number of national security and foreign policy threats today. One man keeping a close watch on those threats is Van Hipp. He's chairman of American Defense International Incorporated. He recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation and joins us now to share some highlights from that presentation. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you see as the number one threat that we're facing today?
Well, it's a more dangerous world today than it was after the day after 9/11. And one of the main reasons is technology is changing faster than our government's ability to adapt. And so I say it's a more dangerous world. As technology changes, the threats increase exponentially. It's a combination of things. You've got radical Islam, but you've got North Korea, you've got cybersecurity, and it all kind of ties together in a way because Iran, a radical Islamist regime, is funding the North Korean threat, cybersecurity. The North Koreans now have a quantum encryption device. That's a scary thing, which the first country to win the race on quantum computing and random number generation could almost prevent hacking. So if they win that race, no matter what we do, it would be very tough to take out their system. So it's this president sure did inherit a mess.
So it sounds as if the biggest threat is the fact that all these other threats can now be more coordinated than they were.
Absolutely. And really, technology is just changing so quickly. And unfortunately, our government is so stovepipe. I think the 9/11 Commission said it best, that 9/11, above all else, was a failure of imagination. We're always responding to the last attack rather than thinking outside of the box to prevent the next one.
How do we then change our mindset and start preparing for these new attacks?
Well, we got to change the way the government does business. I think President Trump is trying to do the right things. He's got to get his people in the Pentagon. I've been saying it for a long time. Too many Obama holdovers, get them out of there. There are many of Trump loyalists out there that he needs to put in the administration who will have his back, who will do the right thing.
Let's take a look at some of the specific threats. I'm going to first of all start with one that's been quite a bit in the news, but for the reasons that the media has been fixated on the Russians and their attempt to influence the elections. Do the Russians in and of themselves, do they constitute a major threat at this point?
You know, the Russian bear, all they ever really respect is strength, if you go back and look through history. And I've been saying that Vladimir Putin is just an old KGB agent who's been masquerading as the president of Russia. But they do oppose a threat, not to the extent that they used to, but they can sure be helpful to us if they wanted to. As far as the Russian election shenanigans, I think Jay Johnson's testimony to Congress was very significant. Didn't get as much media play, where Obama's own Secretary of Homeland Security said that there was no evidence that he saw that the Russian cyber attack influenced the election, changed any altered any votes, or suppressed any votes. That's pretty strong from Obama's own Homeland Security Secretary.
Yeah, it certainly is. Let's turn to some of the other issues as well. You mentioned some of these. What about radical Islam? Radical Islam as a force. How important is it for us to be focusing
on? It's the challenge of our time. And I think King Abdullah of Jordan said it best. He called it World War III in a war within Islam. That's why I think it's important for us to work with moderate and reformed Muslims like King Abdullah of Jordan, also like King Muhammad VI of Morocco, a very strong ally. I just wrote an op-ed about the things that they're doing to help us in the war on terror. Those are the kind of people we need to be working more with. And also, what's going on in these mosques? I've called for a rewards program. If you see something going on in the mosque, if you come forward with actionable intelligence, I've called for a rewards program to encourage people in the mosque to come forward with actionable intelligence.
We are chatting with Van Hipp. He is chairman of American Defense International Incorporated. Another one of our potential threats that's been in the news quite a bit recently is North Korea with all of these missile launches. What is your concern about North Korea these days?
It all comes down to that ballistic missile capability combined with a nuclear threat. I've looked at this for a long time, and we know they have the nuclear warhead design package of the infamous Pakistani scientist Dr. A.Q. Khan. And open source intelligence tells us that Iranians are en route to North Korea now. In the past, almost every time they've gone there, a nuclear test of some sort has followed. So that's the threat to America. I wasn't surprised by the ICBM launch last week. I wrote a piece back in 2012 documenting how they used an Unha 3 rocket to get a satellite in space. So we know they've had this kind of – they were getting very close to having an ICBM. But if they can – and this is what the president, I think, is watching for. We cannot allow them – to have an ICBM that can accommodate a nuclear warhead, and I know they're doing all the diplomatic stuff now, a last attempt there, but the military option is still on the table, and we cannot allow them to have a nuclear warhead on an ICBM that can reach the United States.
Some people have said that it would be enough for them not to necessarily have the material that would cause an explosion on the ground, but to be able to launch something that would lead to an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse attack. That in and of itself could be a problem.
Absolutely, and the EMP Commission has said there is very strong evidence that they may already have two EMP warheads. And that would have the same effect of a geomagnetic storm on the face of the sun. We had one in 1859. That was the last one. I tell people, if you don't believe me, listen to NASA. NASA says it is inevitable in the next 10 to 100 years that we will have another Carrington event. So we've got to harden the grid and have better transformer technology to get our grid up and running, and it's got to be a top priority of our Department of Energy.
Are there some threats out there that you see as important that people just don't even have on their radar at this point?
Well, for a long time I've been talking about North Korea. I didn't think it was on the radar. So finally I think people are getting it. And then the cyber threat. The cyber threat is the most complex national security challenge we've ever faced. I call it the fifth dimension of warfare after air, land, sea, and space. And it's causing not only great national security harm to America, but great economic harm. Every year we're losing more intellectual property among our businesses, universities, government networks than in the entire Library of Congress. It is a major, major threat and one that we've got to get out in front of.
To how big of an extent is it a problem when it's not just the bad guys trying to attack Defense Department computers or that sort of thing, but the people who are sending you these bogus Facebook requests or the spam email? Is that part of this problem as well?
It is. I mean, and the threats are coming from different sources. Primarily, when I say You have to distinguish, for example, between what the Islamists are doing and the Chinese are doing, because each requires different countermeasures from a cyber standpoint. The Chinese are more about espionage and the Islamists are about sabotage. But I would say this, it is primarily a recruitment problem. One of the top experts, James Gosler, has said that we need about 30,000 true cybersecurity experts in America to thwart the worst kind of attack. We've only got about 1,000. I have been calling for national security scholarships on our college campuses and university campuses. Let's recruit the best kids we've got to go into cybersecurity and go into data security.
Well, we know as these issues move forward, one person who's going to be keeping a close watch and telling us all about it is Van Hipp. He is chairman of American Defense International Incorporated. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The term efficiency gap has emerged as a key sticking point in a national battle over drawing election maps. A recent exchange between Democratic State Senator Ben Clark and Republican Representative David Lewis shows that the issue has reached North Carolina.
I asked that for each map that was bought for consideration that an efficiency gap analysis be conducted. Are we going to be able to do that?
First of all, the article that talks about the efficiency gap, which is entitled, I believe, Partisan Gerrymandering and Efficiency Gap by Stephanopoulos and McGee, proposes the use of an efficiency gap concept that is yet to be peer-reviewed by any other legal or academic scholars. Further, I think it's important to point out that the efficiency gap itself is designed to measure election results, and it is based on past election results. I would think it would be disingenuous to try to create proxy election results in order to try to measure an efficiency gap. Further, I think it's important to understand that if you buy into, if you will, the efficiency gap criteria, we would actually be moving away from our current system of government to a European-style parliamentary system. I further believe that the use of this criteria would require the legislature to severely gerrymander in order to dictate a predetermined outcome, and that drawing would require the legislature to reject constitutionally required redistricting criteria, such as the county grouping formula. I say all that to say that I do not believe that the efficiency gap, one, can be applied prospectively, as it has been written about. Two, I reject the argument that an efficiency gap test is a necessary or needed thing. I do not believe that anyone's vote is wasted, which is the premise that the efficiency gap operates on.
Efficiency gaps can be calculated prospectively. There are a lot of articles out there regarding the efficiency gap. And secondly, the capability to do so does exist. With regard to the notion of the wasted votes, that's not it's not implying that an individual's vote is wasted. What is being indicated is that the distribution of those votes through gerrymandering devalues the votes of the citizens, and that is something we should not be doing.
This fall, the U.S. Supreme Court will discuss efficiency gaps in election map making. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. North Carolina lawmakers recently voted to override a veto from Governor Roy Cooper. The governor had targeted a bill dealing with credit insurance. Republican State Representative John Zoka attempted to place the governor's concerns in perspective.
What the language does is it makes a minor revision to current law as it relates to credit property insurance. The bill expands the class of property that is eligible for single interest credit property insurance. It strikes out the word household. That's what it does. It strikes out the word household. So this law was written 30 to 40 years ago. And what we're doing today is acknowledging the types of property that people can own today. So what could you own that's not household property? Well, think of something that you can take off your property at your house. So think of an ATV, an all-terrain vehicle, or a jet ski. I know of no one who buys a jet ski to jet ski in their garage. You take it off your property to use it. Most homeowners' insurance property policies do not cover jet skis and ATVs, and most renters' insurance policies do not cover those type of personal property, even when they're at home. You can get a rider to your insurance policy that can cover it for some types of losses. So what this does, by acknowledging that there are different types of property today, is it allows a person who's financing the purchase of this property, say at a consumer finance place or at a small business that sells these and also finances them, it allows them to purchase this type of insurance.
Zoka says this type of insurance already is legal in other forms.
Now, this type of insurance can also be purchased for personal property that's not covered by household or renter's insurance that you take off of your own land. You can go to all the major carriers or most of the major carriers and buy this exact type of insurance. So generally speaking, how much does that cost if you go to a normal commercial insurance company? I'm not going to mention their names because we see them on TV all the time. How much does it usually cost? It costs about $3.15 per thousand, as high as $8 per thousand. Now, we've all have car insurance and homeowners insurance, so you know that some of the cost of insurance is wrapped up in your credit score and other factors. So if you were to buy this at a consumer finance company or small companies that finance this equipment, and if you get this credit insurance, what's the cost there? And the objection to this, it said it costs more, generally speaking, and I have not surveyed every single company that provides this type of insurance. But generally speaking, in talking to a number of different companies and people who actually provide this, the cost is incredibly less than you get from the major insurance carriers, generally speaking, 87 cents to $1.31 per thousand.
Democrat Deb Butler took Governor Cooper's side and spoke against the measure. Butler says she consulted with some experts in her home city of Wilmington.
We have the privilege of having some of the finest lawyers in the state who analyze predatory lending, the Financial Protection Law Center of Wilmington, North Carolina. And I have consulted with them at length about this, and they tell me in no short order that this type of insurance is predatory in nature. It has a disproportionate effect on poor and unsophisticated buyers, driving the price of their goods and insurance in an astronomical way. Nothing has changed about it since our last gathering. The governor recognizes that, and I urge you to support him in this mission.
Other lawmakers had questions about the measure. One was Republican Larry Pittman of Cabarrus County.
The way it's worded here, I don't read legalese that well, and it looks to me like it's saying that pretty much any property you own except for an automobile could be seized if you don't pay on this loan. Could you explain why I may be wrong about that?
In this type of loan, it's what's known as a secured loan. The terms of the loan are that it's secured by the property. So, for example, if you purchase a Wave Runner or an ATV and you sign up for this type of credit insurance, it only covers that piece of equipment, that if you were to default on the payments, for example, that somebody couldn't come and get your lawnmower or your tractor or your bedroom suite or something else. So it has to be put only on the piece of equipment that you're financing.
Republican John Blust also wanted a clarification.
Could you just give a real-world practical example of this type of insurance and how it works?
I'll use an example of an ATV. We have some folks in here who I'm sure like to go hunt in deer season or any other season. You've purchased an ATV, and they are not cheap. You certainly can't buy one with a $250 cash card that you can buy anywhere at the bank. They cost upwards of $10,000. So once you take that property, that ATV, that $10,000 ATV out with you on your hunting trip, if you run into a tree and you have no insurance, you still owe $10,000 because you have borrowed that money legally and voluntarily, and now you owe $10,000 even though you don't have the use of the ATV because you have collided with a tree and destroyed it. This type of insurance provides protection against that collision.
Democrat Mickey Michaud asked a couple of questions.
Does this legislation make the purchase of this mandatory?
No, sir, it does not. It's always voluntary. State law and federal law actually prohibits the coupling of mandatory insurance with consumer purchases of this type. So it is not mandatory.
I don't know how many poor folks really buy ATVs, but why is the legislation necessary?
The reason for it is, again, to include those classes of property that have changed in the last 20 or 30 years. My example is jet skis, ATVs, which when this law was originally written, people didn't have those, so it wasn't really that common. So it's not a major change in the law. It's a minor change to recognize new classes of property that people can take off of their personal homestead where they live. So it's just trying to update things the way people actually live today.
Democrat Ken Goodman wanted to know about protection for consumers.
Does the lender have to disclose to the buyer that this insurance is not mandatory?
Absolutely, yes. To be in full compliance with the law, he has to say that it is not mandatory. And, in fact, the forms that are put in front of the customer to sign state that very fact.
Does the lender have to clearly disclose the price of the insurance?
That is correct. He does.
Does the lender get to decide how much to charge a consumer for this insurance?
And that's actually a very good question. The lender does not get to decide that. That is decided by the insurance carrier. He is merely providing that option at the point of sale.
Republican Representative Jeff Collins reminded his colleagues that the bill does not turn an illegal product into a legal product.
This type of insurance is not illegal already. And as Representative Zoka has said, if you've listened carefully, if we allow this new group to do it, the prices will actually be better than what people are currently offered on this type of insurance, which is already legal in North Carolina.
You've been listening to Debate about a bill that permits a new way of selling credit insurance in North Carolina. Lawmakers overrode a veto from Governor Roy Cooper to turn the bill into law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. New education data from the State Department of Public Instruction is helping to point us to some trends, some successes, and some real concerns. Among the headlines, according to Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation, statewide proficiency and four-year graduation rates have inched up, but there was a slight decline in the percentage of schools exceeding growth expectations. And Dr. Stoops joins us now to look at the data. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you.
First of all, let's talk about the graduation rate situation. Where are we?
Well, according to most of the reports, we have the highest reported graduation rate that we've ever had at 86.5%. And it's true. We have our graduation rate has been increasing every year for many years. We hear a lot that this graduation rate is an indicator that students are being successful, that they're getting through school in greater numbers, and that they're prepared for college and career after they graduate. But I have some doubts about that, and I think I indicate that in some of the things that I've said and written about these test scores.
Let's talk about the community college remediation rate. First of all, what does that mean, and why is it significant?
Well, it asks the question, how many students that graduate and go directly to a North Carolina community college need remedial classes in math and English? And we find that around a third of community college students, and these are recent graduates and not students going back to the community college after being in the workforce, need remedial math and reading. And we're not talking about complex math. We're not talking about very difficult English language arts things. We're talking about what they should have learned in high school. And recently we learned that a lot of students in high school are taking credit recovery courses. And these are courses that are pass-fail that essentially allows them to skirt the regular curriculum, take these very brief courses and pass them to get them counted toward their graduation. And this is really of particular concern because now that we have a higher quantity of graduates, the question is, what is the quality of those graduates? And I think we need to start asking very serious questions about that.
That certainly isn't going to help that student at all who gets out with a college or with a high school diploma but isn't prepared really to either go on to college or some sort of training or go into the workforce.
It's not, and I fear that the graduation rate is being used mostly for political ends to say, look, we're succeeding in North Carolina. The graduation rate keeps going up. But the problem is that as it goes up, we are graduating more and more kids, it seems, that really aren't prepared for what they're going to encounter in the workforce or in higher education. So that's why we need to start taking a serious look at this issue.
So how are we doing before those kids actually get out of school? Are kids learning? Are they entering a grade, for example, and then coming out at the end of that school year having illustrated that they actually have learned and have grown in their knowledge?
Well, we're seeing fairly positive trends with student growth. If you look at all of our growth targets across the entire state, around three-quarters, about 75% of students are either meeting or exceeding growth. Around 25% are not. And that's very positive. But that's only really one half of the story. The other half is how many of those students are actually proficient. So growth measures how far they have gotten in the school year. Are they meeting what we would expect them to do over the course of a year? But a student may be able to grow during that year, but still not even be close to being grade level proficient. So, while 75% of students are meeting or exceeding growth expectations, only around 57% are proficient in English. Around 55% are proficient in math. And this is really what we need to be worried about. And this is in grades three through eight. We really need to be mindful that even though they're making growth, they also need to be grade level proficient. And we're barely breaking 50% of students that are proficient in these subjects. And in some grades, it's even lower than 50%.
Well, Terry, if that's the case, then are these kids moving on to the next grade?
It depends. If they're in third grade because of the Read to Achieve program, sometimes they're not moving on because the Read to Achieve program for third grade literacy says that if you are not grade level proficient by third grade, then you may be held back. Now, there are some caveats to that and students may make up the requirements in other ways. But for the most part, they're not being held back. They get to continue on and, we're seeing that as students move through middle school, proficiency rates go down. And that's because these students aren't grade level proficient in the early grades. And they continue to fall further and further behind as they go through elementary and middle school. So by the time they reach eighth grade, we have some of the lowest proficiency rates across all subjects because these students have been passed on.
Terry, are we seeing any trends in the data that would indicate to us certain subgroups of students who are maybe particularly doing well or subgroups of students that have really kind of difficult challenges and just need extra help?
Sure. Well, it really comes as no surprise that white students and Asian students really have really excelled in our testing system. We're seeing that Hispanic students, African-American students, students with disabilities and second or English as a second language students continue to struggle. There continues to be an achievement gap. We are not doing a very good job of closing that achievement gap. We're not seeing really the kind of gains that we need to see in order to ensure that those students who have traditionally struggled are getting up to where the other students are. And let me just say that this has been happening for decades. There's nothing new about the achievement gap, and there's nothing new about these subgroups struggling or these other groups succeeding. This is not a creation of Republican legislators, but this is a thorny problem that states beyond North Carolina are dealing with and having a hard time solving.
Terry, within the public school system, we have traditional classrooms, the traditional public school, but then we have public charter schools, which are in some ways outside the system, but are definitely part of it as well. Any trends between those charter schools and traditional district schools that we're seeing in any of the scores or the proficiency rates?
Yes. Well, it's important to, and this is probably the least reported subject, but charter schools are outperforming district schools as a whole. If you look at their school performance grades, and a lot of people have just realized that North Carolina now grades schools A through F. That wasn't the case years ago where we would give them names that no one knew what they meant. Right. We now grade them A through F, and if you look at the A through F system, you have a higher percentage of charter schools getting A's and B's than the district schools, but you have a higher percentage of charter schools getting F's compared to the district system. And this is how this has occurred since we've incorporated the A through F system a few years ago.
Now, obviously, a school that is particularly repeatedly getting F grades is a problem, whether they're a traditional school or a charter school, but there is a difference about how they're handled.
Well, if you're an F school in the charter system, you can face closure, and a lot of schools do if they have persistent low performance on state tests. They are subject to closure. What's interesting this year is that those schools in the district system that are D's or F's are put on a list and may become part of the Innovation School District, what used to be called the Achievement School District, and be taken over by this school district to receive special attention from a charter school operator and perhaps as an attempt to raise student achievement. So there are consequences in the district system, but they get extra help. And the charter schools get faced with the possibility of closure.
Well, it's fascinating data. The very latest data from the State Department of Public Instruction on test scores, graduation rates, proficiency scores, et cetera. The analysis comes from our guest, Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. You can read his entire piece at johnlocke.org. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.